Do you have any questions about those? Okay, and I will remind everyone in the audience to please turn off your cell phones or pagers or any other kind of device that might go off during the arguments, please. And with that, we are ready to proceed when you are, counsel.
Good afternoon. May it please the court. My name is Susan Trin Almany. My attorney registration number is 26281. Due to the limited time today, I won't address all the issues that were raised in the briefs, but we do stand on all the arguments that were submitted. The first issue I'd like to address today is actually the one numbered 2 in the briefs, which relates to the suppression issues. And first, I think it's important to keep in mind that there are two distinct areas of law related to this suppression issue. The first is the entry into the motel room, and then the second is the interaction between the police and Mr. Salazar. So the first issue is the entry into the room, which really narrows down to the question of consent. And of course, the people concede in their answer brief that the district court erroneously failed to make a factual finding regarding the issue of consent. Now, normally, a limited remand would be the appropriate remedy for the district court's failure to make that factual finding, but we're asserting today that remand is actually unnecessary because this Court of Appeals can find that Mr. Salazar did not get consent based on the record before it.
Well, the police officer testified that he did give consent. The judge in the first hearing found that he did give consent based on the police officer's testimony. And actually, he never said, I don't find there's consent. He just said, even if I were to accept Mr. Salazar's testimony and find there was no consent, I see alternative legal basis for allowing this entry. So I'm not sure how, given that scenario, we can possibly conclude that there was a lack of consent.
That's correct, Your Honor, but what I realized as I more carefully looked at the district court's ruling on that consent issue was, as you stated, the district court originally ruled that Mr. Salazar did not give consent. That was based on Agent Langley's testimony alone. That he did give consent. That was based on Agent Langley's testimony alone. Then, after Mr. Salazar had an opportunity to testify, the district court had the ability to then rule, well, I affirm my previous ruling that there was consent. The district court did not do that. It did not affirm its previous ruling of consent.
I reaffirm my findings and conclusions with regard to the motions. He did say that, and then you're right, he sort of backtracked, and he said, well, even if I don't find consent, I'm still going to uphold the search.
Right. So our argument is, perhaps based on judicial economy, we don't really need to send it back on limited remand, that this court could review that order by the district court and view it as the district court basically saying, all right, there was no consent, but still we are affirming our ultimate conclusion that the officers entered properly into the motel room.
Also, setting aside the consent issue, what do you make of the people's argument about harmless error, and in particular that even without the hotel room and the consent issue, that you have the hotel manager identifying the defendant in the truck that's at issue, and the police observation of various indicators to it that a burglary or a theft had occurred inside the vehicle?
Yes, Your Honor, I think that without any of the evidence after the entry into the motel room, that there is certainly, and I'm looking for my standard here, the standard for harmless error is a reasonable doubt, beyond a reasonable doubt, I'm sorry. And I think that if all you have is the police officer's initial observations of the truck and the hotel manager's statement that that truck was associated with the defendant, that is insufficient to find him guilty of receiving stolen property in this case.
And the fact that the truck was stolen.
Ultimately, later found to be stolen, but not determined to be stolen for another 3 hours, which, you know, without having entered into the hotel room, they did not have the screwdriver that was found inside the motel room. They don't have any of the defendant's statements, which are extensive.
Let me ask you about that then. Your motion to suppress, or the defendant's motion to suppress, I understand was addressed to suppressing the ashtray that was seen in the hotel room and the screwdriver that was seen in the hotel room. And you say, generally, statements, okay? Can you be more specific about what statement the defendant made after the entry in the hotel room that came into evidence at the trial that would have been kept out if it had been suppressed?
Sure. His statements of denial.
Denial meaning what?
Denying that he
had anything
to do with the truck either.
Didn't he say that when they knocked on the door and asked him before they entered? That's how I read the record.
From my understanding of the record, the first statements were just, you know, related to entering the motel room. I believe that they entered the motel room first and then asked him, you know, is this your truck out here, and so on.
I understand. We want to ask you questions about the truck, and he said, I don't know, and I'm not nothing of that truck. And that was before the entry of the hotel room. You think it was after the entry?
I believe it was just as they entered, after they entered.
What other statement?
It was the first statement, though.
Would it make a difference in your analysis if it occurred before they entered?
For that single statement, yes. Yes. But then there are many statements after that, which relate to, you know, first, I don't know anything about the truck. Then it was, I actually have papers for the truck. So there were numerous statements that were conflicting.
What else did he say besides, I have papers for the truck. If you look in the hotel room, you'll find them. I didn't see any other reference in the record to another statement by him that would have been suppressed if you were correct. But I'd like to know what they are, because that's what you're asking us to suppress. And that's what you're asking us to weigh for harmless error. Or you're not there.
Sure. Well, and actually what I'd really like to move on to, and I do want to go over those statements that he made, but I think that aside from the consent issue, the real issue is what kind of interaction this was, whether it was an arrest or an investigatory stop, because that determines, regardless of consent, I think we can break this down into whether or not he gave consent for the officers to enter the motel room. If not, then the evidence at issue would be that was in plain view, and the statement, I don't know anything about this truck. But then what happens after that is that soon thereafter, they place handcuffs on him, and the question is, was he arrested at that point? And then the statements that he made after he was handcuffed are the ones related to that issue.
The statements that he made after he was handcuffed that you were seeking to suppress, I couldn't determine from the record you were seeking to suppress.
Okay, so let me see if I can help.
I mean, from your briefs.
Point you in the direction of those statements. But before I get there, I want to point out that Agent Langley at the motions hearing stated that he did not arrest Mr. Salazar. And he was the officer at the motions hearing that testified regarding that issue of whether it was an arrest or an investigatory stop. Later, at trial, Agent Swainson testified that, in fact, Mr. Salazar was told that he was under arrest at the time he was handcuffed. So, frankly, based on Agent Swainson's testimony alone, we can just end the analysis there.
So assuming he was arrested unlawfully, that's what I'd like to know.
Get those statements before. I know that there was a statement where he said, I have papers for it. I think there were, statements.
Statement that says, "I have papers for the car. You'd find him in the hotel room if you looked." That came into evidence at the trial, right?
It did.
I assume it came through the police officer's testimony. Salazar didn't testify.
I believe so, but
what else came in at the trial that would be said by the defendant after the allegedly unlawful arrest?
And I'm sorry, I think I have that back in my folder there, and I'd like to reserve some time during.
Okay, that's fine.
During
help us, counsel, when you seek to suppress something, to know what it is that's
point those out to you exactly. And also, I think that just his just everything that occurred after that too would be suppressed. Any evidence of his behavior, which might not be verbal statements, but his,
let's talk about that. You don't think that his conduct in the police car is subject to being suppressed, or he tries to get out of the car, takes off the handcuffs. Whatever he said, that he barely made some very damning, violence type statements. Then those aren't suppressible, are they?
I think that they're all fruits of the poisonous tree. Once you have an illegal arrest, then everything after that is fruit of the poisonous tree that is suppressed from trial.
Okay.
Okay.
I understand what you're saying.
I have just a few minutes, and I do want to reserve some time. I think that even if we go beyond Agent Swainson's testimony at trial, we have an arrest because the actions of the officers that is handcuffing and placing Mr. Salazar into their police car, those have been traditionally considered to be force typically associated with an arrest. And the district court's finding that this was a mere investigatory stop isn't justified based on the district court's finding that, well, there was concern that maybe he was going to that he was escaping. And in fact, he was not, the case law actually calls for a continuing and active flight. But in this case, Mr. Salazar was not in flight at all. He was just perhaps making some, he was glancing at the door as if he wanted, according to the police officers, as if he wanted to run out the door. But there were no other gestures. And in fact, the police officer said he was very cooperative in the motel room. So I think that the district court's finding that there was justification for such force is not supported in the evidence. I did want to touch on the competence issue, which was our first issue. And just to, I think that one of the main points I wanted to raise was that Judge Russell, who was the judge who actually heard the testimony of the psychiatrists and psychologists and the defense attorney and the investigator, the judge who actually heard all of that testimony related to Mr. Salazar's competence, was the judge who should have made the determination whether he was competent to proceed.
Why?
Competent at trial.
Why?
Because I think that handing it back to the trial judge in this particular case especially was not supported, because the trial judge then only was reading the transcripts.
Counsel, let me just ask you a question, okay?
Mm-hmm.
16-8-111, the statute that governed at the time, says, upon the request of either party, the judge shall set the matter for hearing before another judge, okay? Was such a request made by the defendant that the matter should be set before another judge?
Yes, I believe it was.
Well, I'm looking at the motion for mistrial that was filed by Ms. O'Brien on August 27th, which cites the statute, subparagraph 1, and I don't see anything in here that says set the matter before another judge. So if it's in the record, you ought to point that out.
I'm sorry, and I'm not sure which you're referring to. I think that when they set it before another judge, it was originally before the trial judge, and they set it before another judge, which was Judge Russell. So he was the one who ended up, instead of the trial judge holding the hearings on competence.
There were two different motions, though. One was competence for sentencing. That was set before another judge, obviously.
Subsequently, Ms. O'Brien filed this motion for mistrial for competency at time of trial. In this motion, I don't see any request that it be set before another judge. She apparently, whoever did it, apparently did that with respect to the competency for sentencing, but I don't see it anywhere in the competency for trial. So I don't see how the statute was complied with. That's really my point. If it's there, you maybe you should point out this, but I didn't see it. That's what I'm getting at.
Oh, I see. And I think that it was, she requested that it be set before another judge on the issue of competence, and that was both trial and sentencing, from my reading of the record. It appears I'm out of time.
All right, I'm sorry to interrupt.
Thank you, Your Honor.
May it please the court, Paul Kaler. I'm First Assistant Attorney General at the Department of Law. My registration number is 19210. I'll just take the issues in reverse order. The evidence on the competency issue is mixed. The defendant had some evidence. The prosecution had, we think, more evidence based on the examination at the state hospital. Because the evidence is mixed, I think this court needs to affirm the trial court's ultimate finding that the defendant had been competent at the time of trial.
Mr. Bondurant, at the time of this hearing, Dusky, I guess, was a controlling standard. Can you indicate to us whether Judge Berryhill actually made a finding as to the standards of Dusky? Did he actually make a finding that the defendant was capable of assisting counsel, that he was capable of understanding the proceedings? I don't see where he uses the Dusky language.
Dusky is the federal case, Your Honor.
Followed by the state court.
Right. And actually, I can't remember what the exact language used, but I think it's under our normal implicit findings that if the trial court had not believed that the defendant had been
capable of assisting his counsel in understanding the proceedings.
Right, Your Honor.
I don't see the judge ever said that.
I don't recall that, Your Honor.
Okay. So should we remand it for findings on that?
If this court could think that a change in the standard or a trial court's failure to articulate the exact standard would make a difference, I don't think that would be the case here because, first of all, the trial court saw no evidence during the year and a half of proceedings that it had seen the defendant, that the defendant had been before him, that there was any problem with his competency. His counsel did not raise the claim until right before sentencing when she told the court that the defendant himself wanted to present the claim and not he himself. And then the state hospital's examination where two psychiatrists and one psychologist had examined the defendant and determined that he had been malingering his symptoms. So I don't think there would be any reason for a remand because the trial court did not exactly read either the Dusky standard itself or the statute as it is under the exact language of the statute.
Also a case called Mondragon that was decided by a division of this court after this hearing. I don't know if you've looked at that case. I think the defendant cited it. Does that change the analysis? Does that change the standard that we're supposed to apply?
I can't pull up the holding in that case. What part of that case does concern you, Your Honor?
And use this language. It says, under the Dusky standard, a defendant lacks the requisite rational understanding if he does not have a sufficient contact with reality and if his mental condition precludes him from perceiving accurately, interpreting, and or responding appropriately to the world around him. Or the defendant's perceptions and understanding are not rational and grounded in reality. Now, the defendant argues that there was no finding like that by Judge Berryhill. Certainly, that language wasn't really used. Does that require a remand? I mean, does that change the Dusky standard?
I don't think so, Your Honor. I think the evidence concerned whether the defendant was able to understand what was going on, and the evidence was, and in the trial, the evidence was that the defendant had been malingering his symptoms, and that it was just an attempt to avoid being sentenced on this particular case. The suppression issue, I think, only affects the theft by receiving conviction. It doesn't affect, we don't think, the resisting arrest or the menacing charges because under the statute 18.8.103 sub 2, the legality of arrest does not affect whether a person is entitled to resist arrest. So those convictions, I don't think, are changed at all by what we concede is a problem in the trial court's failure to determine whether the police officers entered with permission or not. And obviously, the trial court should have made that finding.
Well, your counterpart goes on to say that maybe we should be remanding on the issue of consent, since there wasn't a specific finding by the trial court.
Right. I think it's clear this court can order that, and I think as a result of our concession, that would be something this court could do. However, at least in my reading of the record, there were only two pieces of evidence that came in as a result of this entry: the flat-bladed screwdriver that was found in the room that was similar to the one that was on the seat of the stolen truck, and also the ashtray that had been pulled out of the dashboard of the truck that was of the same color. I don't think that really affects the validity of the theft by receiving count. Obviously, the truck had been stolen, the door lock had been punched, the ignition had been punched. There had been an attempt made to cover up that the ignition had been punched. The truck had, in fact, been stolen. The defendant had been seen driving the truck. It was parked outside of his room. I think clearly the truck had been stolen and the defendant was in possession of it. And under the, that was more than sufficient evidence to support his conviction for theft by receiving, apart from, pardon me, the ashtray and the screwdriver in his room.
What about the statements that counsel says she wants to, the defendant wants to suppress, though we don't know exactly what they are yet, except the one about, I have the papers, they're in the motel room, that one's been identified.
Right, I think those are, well, they're all obviously self-serving statements, and they're all really the defendant had in order to present his defense. I don't know if he could disavow those statements that he had bought the car from someone else and he had the proper paperwork in his room. Those were not, pardon me, necessarily evidence of guilt, but rather evidence to support his theory that he was an innocent purchaser of this truck and he was not guilty of theft at all.
But that statement's inconsistent with what he originally said, which is, I know nothing about this truck. So if both statements came in, I suppose, and I don't know, the prosecution could argue, well, this guy's obviously not telling the truth. One of these times, either he did have something to do with the truck because by his own statement he legally purchases, or nothing to do with the truck because he says, you know, so he's a liar. You know, did they argue that? Was that a credibility argument made based on those statements?
I can't recall that at all. I can't recall whether or not, either way, Your Honor. I think, though, I don't know anything about this truck could also be interpreted as meaning, I don't know whether this truck was stolen or not because I'm an innocent buyer of it, but as I said in the brief, I think we have a harmless error argument. I don't really care if you send it back to the trial court to make the proper finding that was needed to determine whether this was a consensual entry or not.
Legal matter, you do concede that if the court doesn't find consent, the entry is not lawful.
Oh, sure. Okay. No, I have no problem with that, Your Honor. Just briefly, I think apart from the issue of whether the entry was consensual or not, I think this was a proper investigatory detention that the trial court made sufficient findings of that. The police officers obviously had reasonable suspicion to believe that the truck had been stolen and that the defendant was connected to it. And also based on their experience as police officers, the defendant asking for his shoes, his nervous action in the room, him looking towards the door, they obviously had good grounds to want to control the situation to try and prevent him from trying to escape. Obviously, as was shown later on, where the defendant went to rather great efforts to escape, including not only pulling his hands out from behind him, to fighting the police officers, to taking eight or whatever, until he wore out the battery on the taser unit after getting shocked so many times. Obviously, the police officers here correctly determined his intent to make an escape attempt, and they had enough information at the time to support their use of handcuffs and putting him in the back of the police car until they could determine whether, in fact, this truck had been stolen or not.
So any statements you made in the course of that activity, if they came in, are not subject to being suppressed for an unlawful arrest? That's what
I don't think so, Your Honor.
Okay. I think counsel was suggesting that, but I see your point. Okay.
I have really nothing else, some other burning compulsions to talk about anything else. Are there any other issues the court would like me to try to address? Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. This matter will stand submitted, and an opinion will issue in due course. Thank you.
Thank you.